eyebrow drivel of the highest order.
An absolute disgrace.
That's some good
absolute drivel, I do say, my goodness. Now that's some good-ass highbrow drivel, you hear me?
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Highbrow Drivel. Today we'll be talking about memes, and funnily enough, this episode turned out to be one of the most serious I've recorded, partly because there was no guest comedian on this one, and partly because memes hold such a weirdly important part of the political dialogue at this point. Personally, I became sort of really interested in memes when I was working at a communication agency, and as a junior, my whole full-time job was to find dank memes and share them with kids for a teenage fashion brand. And the kids would see the memes and they'd go, oh my God, it's a photo of Rihanna frowning next to a photo of Rihanna smiling with the caption, my two moods, this brand gets me, and they would pay us money and I'd keep my job. And since then, we've obviously seen a huge shift in the amount of news journalism that is delivered by memes. In fact, just this year, I discovered Donald Trump had coronavirus when I saw a meme that said, roses are red, the grass is green, Donald Trump got COVID-19. They hold a weirdly important part in our information discovery cycle. So I wanted to talk about that, and I spoke to Dr. Bradley Wiggins, who is an author and researcher and a head of media. It is worth noting as a disclaimer, this episode was recorded in November last year, so significantly before Viking and Dumber decided to storm the Capitol. And I think what is interesting listening to this episode back now in light of what happened is that it's just another great example of how we on the left told you this is where your actions were heading, and then you sat around with your hands in your pocket and said there's good people on both sides, and then now you pretend to be surprised that the people you've been encouraging, the cages you've been rattling, that those fucking wild dogs have gone and acted like idiots. I think this is a great example of one of the millions of conversations that have happened over the last decade that should have served as a warning but didn't. I hope you enjoy the conversation. At what stage in memes taking over, like becoming ubiquitous with conversation, do you think people started to take them seriously as a communication device?
That's a very good question. It's a very astute question. As a communication device, because the way that's phrased, it's quite broad. I see what you're saying. I would say one can make the argument it started around 2010 with the Occupy movement. But I would go later, actually. I would say the confluence of the European immigration crisis in 2015-16, Brexit 2016, and then the Trump electoral victory in 16, that even though that's decidedly a more of a political thing, I just think that elevated the perception of importance, not necessarily the importance of the meme as a piece of, a communicative artifact or something, but rather that it, and there's a lot of different ways to interpret this, but that it has some kind of identity relationship for different groups, different in-groups. And that's the rub, so to speak. That's the thing that I look into and a lot of other researchers look into beyond the actual, you know, whether it's a remix of some politician as Voldemort, you know, and you can get the laugh and then you share. But within that message is some kind of worldview, some kind of ideological stance. Now, of course, a lot of them are just funny, but even the ones that are kind of superficially funny, there's some kind of critique, as you would agree, at the core of humor. There's some degree of pain sometimes when you make fun of a group or when you make fun of a politician or whatever it might be. There's a little bit of pain there, you know. So I think that has also transferred as well. And I would say that to close on that point, humor itself, the research into humor, being an academic researcher, I would say that I would have to acknowledge that there's a lot of like pre-meme research that was done and investigation into it. But I don't think any of it could possibly have foreseen how pervasive it's become and mainstream and yet completely hidden too. You know, there are ways like far right groups use symbols and you know, that I there's so many examples that it just goes off the radar and you don't know what it means, right? And then they develop something else and it becomes more mainstream or whatever.
Yeah, that is the far right groups is definitely something I want to get to, but before we do, I'm super interested in terms of, like, you had a couple of dates that you were sort of tossing up in your mind there in terms of 2010, 2016. Is there any rough, or is there any efforts to kind of almost similar to the evolution of human tools in the Dark Ages and the Industrial Age? Is there any effort being made to do that with memes in terms of like, oh, the Velociraptor, Philosophy Raptor age, where it was a little bit more innocent, and then a kind of plot to move to the evolution to this thing that has become, at least in part, largely a political device?
You're asking if there's been a specific change, or I think I get the most of the question, but like...
Yeah, if there's been an effort made to map the way that has evolved from sort of one, because I guess that there's been aesthetic changes and trends, but then there's also been messaging changes. Has there been an effort to plot the way that that's married up?
Yes, I think so. Maybe not in as direct a way as you're suggesting, but it makes sense. I know the work of Whitney Phillips and Ryan Milner, they've looked at just the notion of ambiguity, how ambiguity, whether you talk about memes or anything else, that it seems to be really pervasive, as well as a kind of neo-millennial distanced or dark irony, you know, a very ironic stance to things, dark humor. That has seemed to have become more common. And for whatever reason, to get back to your question, the meme, I think, is just a perfect vehicle for that type of humor. So I guess what I'm suggesting is perhaps online, you know, discourse, the way people talk online, the challenges of daily life, and that was before the pandemic, right? So the different kind of challenges that we face, there's a kind of understandable position that you would retreat to your screen in your pocket, you know, and look at your screen and you want to be amused. It seems to gravitate more toward a kind of acerbic, ironic stance, as opposed to, you know, just quote unquote harmless fun.
Yeah. I think that irony, and one of my previous guests used the word irony poisoning, which I really like, has to some extent made it very easy for groups with inherent political motivations to hide views that would otherwise be rejected, and manage to hide them in plain sight in a way that they spread and infiltrate mainstream culture and conversation. Obviously, the biggest conversation around that was the way Pepe the Frog or the OK symbol had been co-opted as ways for, as a wink and a nudge for people to show their allegiance to a set of ideas. Is that something that you're looking into, and what is the research saying around that?
That's another good question. I mean, you know, to keep it as sort of light and conversational as possible, I just want to mention at least two projects that I worked on. the one is finished. The one's a published article, which I'll talk about in a moment. And the other one is a work in progress with a colleague from Amsterdam. And in that piece, we are looking at the title of that is No More Dead Memes, a new materialist approach to detect far-right activism. And it sounds like we're proposing a way of examining it in a way of finding it, but it's more a way of understanding how a network like 4chan, for example, or the various ones before it, 8chan, 8kun, how it's best not to think of it in terms of top-down hierarchical, but rather as a rhizome, as a structure that has no real center. Very, very much actually like QAnon, the QAnon conspiracy theory group, whatever you want to call it. There's no real head. People might refer to a Q, or sometimes they even refer to Trump as the head, but there's no real head. You know, they're just a sharing of a kind of belief structure. And in a similar vein, I suppose, I was super productive at the beginning of the year. And I wrote this piece called Boogaloo and Civil War II, Mimetic Antagonism and Expressions of Covert Activism. And what I was looking at was there was a gun rally that happened in Virginia, Richmond, Virginia, and on January 10th of this year. And I had already been sort of, how best to describe it, disgusted by but sort of oddly attracted to this resurgent, highly white supremacist, racist, misogynistic, and homophobic groups in the U.S., which clearly got their a green light by Trump's various rhetorical approaches. And the Boogaloo is a kind of metaphor for a very serious, violent insurrection of the U.S. government. And there's more to it than that. So, yes, I have looked at these far-right groups, and the best way I could summarize all of it would be as follows. Those memes or mimetic messages, whatever you want to call them, that tend to be, let's just say, somewhere on the left or left of center or progressive or something like that, if they're critical of another group, okay, they're going to be, you know, a little tough maybe, but it's going to be in fun. It might be somewhat serious. However, on the other side, on the right wing of politics, whatever, it is downright vitriol. It is just vomitous hate. I mean, I remember the ones in 2016, the memes about Trump was that he was a kind of chaotic figure. He's an idiot. But about Hillary? Holy. I mean, it was just pure misogyny, And yeah, it's there's something there. There's something there where the meme itself has a kind of, an opportunity for individuals to brand themselves and has like a kind of emblem that they can share and they get the wink, like you said before. And they feel kind of that they don't have to be sort of in the closet, as it were, like they can be more out, but hidden in these distributed networks. So that's,
Do you think there is something? So obviously the nature of memes is that they are very brief communication devices. Do you think there is something in the format? Because there is the classic meme that the left can't meme is a meme in and of itself. Is the format one that suits a reductive sense of humor in such a way that, like, you know, a right-wing person can write, you know, all X is Y in a really reductive way, and in general, the right is more comfortable with communicating in that kind of reductive terms. Whereas if the left want to explain under X circumstances Y could be said to be true, it doesn't meme so well. Has that been an influence in political discussion, the reduction of the format?
Really good. Another good question. That's definitely a red line through it, or a red thread through it. there's this, I mean, you said it very, very eloquently. I mean, there is a kind of inability on the left to be a bit more acerbic, as opposed, like, what they are good at, I think, and one can debate how effective this is they're good at, how would you call that? Hijacking, I guess you could say, this is a relatively new development, so jumping ahead a little bit, where the left seems to be pretty good at taking the images or the hashtags or something like that in between of the right, and then we'll use the exact same hashtags or images to say something critical about the group. And then I've seen some examples, I mean, on Instagram, on TikTok, on Twitter, where you get a sense that there's a kind of movement of awareness, but still you have these corners of the web, like this, that this, the group on 4chan poll or the K group, they just discuss weapons and such. A lot of it is really far right stuff. So there are these spaces still. I don't know if that really got to the core of your question, but I'd be happy to reconsider your question.
One thing I would love to know, because listening to you talk about the way you have to, like the way you are studying these things and on these message boards, I imagine you are exposed to a lot of, to put it bluntly, fucked up shit. How do you manage to kind of stop that affecting you personally?
I tell you, okay, real quick story, real quick example. I had to write a sample chapter for the book that's in print now through Routledge. I had to write a sample chapter, which was peer-reviewed, and you get feedback on it. And the chapter that I wrote on at that time, this was 2016, so before the election. And I chose to go with politics, and it centered mostly on Pepe the Frog and Trump. And I felt at that time that what I was writing, what I was implying, was going a bit too far. I all but said Trump's a Nazi. And then Charlottesville happened a year later, and Trump said there are good people on both sides. And the review process for the chapter and then the approval, this takes a long time. The book was published in March of 2019. So there's a lot of revisions in between. So when that happened, I just realized, and it wasn't just that time. There were many other examples, and not just about the U.S., not just about, also we could look at China, we could look at Russia, I mean, a lot of other examples. But I went to the gym frequently. I needed to get away from it because it is very dark. I have a certain skill, I think, of being rather objective, even when I write about the stuff that I don't agree with. Of course, I don't put myself into it. I try to present it as what it is, and then hopefully the viewer, the reader, rather, kind of knows where I'm going with that. But yeah, it's. I mean, one of them, good God, there have been some absolutely disgusting and nasty ones. That's not a surprise, but I guess for me, when I see it like that, what I'm thinking in my mind right now is a meme that was posted in response to the U.S. Supreme Court hearing for Brett Kavanaugh. And he was accused of sexual harassment. I can't remember the woman's name. I apologize. Someone remixed it so that her shirt basically implied that she was there for a gangbang. And, you know, I thought, what is wrong with these people? And then another time after the George Floyd murder this year, I don't know if you know this, there were plenty of reenactments of white dudes putting their knee or their foot or whatever, I forget what it was, on people's necks as a way of participating in this spectacle of fill in the blank, racism, I'm oppressed white person, you know, however they understand that, it's horrible. And I just, I'll take a break once in a while, but I guess my point in saying all that was that I take the rather hard line stance that just because a meme is clearly racist, the person who creates it may or may not fall into that category. That's why I don't really do a lot of research on 4chan, because you see a lot of emergent memes there. But the people who share it, who like it, that's what concerns me, because those are the individuals who know exactly what it means, who want to get the message out. And that is something I just find disturbing. I think it's indicative of a kind of malaise, too much information, and people just sort of retreat into their little chambers, little echo chambers.
That's actually a really interesting point. So in your research, your read of it is that there are places where these memes emerge and are designed with a level of malicious intent. And then there are, separate to that, once it gets to mainstream platforms, people who share things because there is a level of information overload and detachment, and they may be, whether it's willful ignorance or something else, sharing these without fully interrogating how problematic the positions they're putting forward are.
Yeah, it is a good distinction to make. I don't know how there is a kind of category or subcategory of memes where you really need to know more context to get it, and that's part of the project I'm working on right now called No More Dead Memes. The reason for that title is because this should get to your question. In these forums, in 4chan, for example, and I'm new to doing research in 4chan, by the way. I've done research on other platforms primarily, but 4chan is somewhat new for me in terms of research, not in terms of knowing about how it functions. There's kind of an in-group inside joke, if you will, that once whatever the meme, be it an image, be it a certain phrase, be it whatever, whenever it leaves that group and becomes taken up, or we're calling it transcoded to Instagram or Twitter, they then consider it a dead meme and switch to something else. And I think the lesson that they learned was the lesson from Pepe the Frog, that first very much seemed like totally innocuous. And then it basically functions as a swastika for the 21st century, as would be my claim of what Pepe the Frog really is. So to your question, the people who are unwittingly sharing the memes that are more innocuous, less obvious, sure, let's give them a pass. But those are pretty few and far between. You know, those are, you know, you're sharing, it's even the ones that like take a screenshot of Quentin Tarantino's film Inglourious Basterds, where they're killing Nazis, but they remix it to kill liberals. You know what you're sharing. You know what I mean? Like, you know what you're sharing.
I wonder if you've seen much or got much of opinion on the way that these people who the ones who do know what they're sharing, when they get called out on it, play dumb, despite the fact that they almost certainly do know better. And I've got one example from back home in Australia that I imagine you may not have seen, but fits a pattern that I've seen elsewhere, and I wonder if you've seen similar, in that there is a celebrity chef, because that's where all good opinions come from, who went crazy and started on the paleo diet because, again, before any mainstream celebrity ends up a Nazi, they have to muck around with some kind of weird hippie stuff. And so that was his kind of first step off the mainstream path, and then he became increasingly alt-right and shared a lot of literature in that regard. And after the most recent US election, he shared a caterpillar in a MAGA hat saying something about what happens next. And then on the other half of the comic strip was a butterfly that had a black sun in its wings saying, "We evolve," right? And the minute he shared that, there were a bunch of like quite astute left-wing activists who follow him because he's a shithead who said, you know damn well what you're doing. That's a black sun and a Nazi symbol. And his first response to that was a comment that was, "I was waiting for somebody to point that out." And then a day later, when he started losing book contracts and TV gigs, he started playing dumb and saying, "Oh, I'm so sorry that I don't know every symbol and the etymology of them across time." And it is, from my perspective, it's not the first time you get people sharing stuff that they, I think, know too well is got a lot of symbolism in it, and then trying to play dumb. Is that something that you think is done strategically and deliberately, or do you think it's just a reactionary thing when they do get called out?
Okay. I need to start with this first, and then feel free to bring me back in if I stray off. But there was a time, and this is somewhat anecdotal, so take it for what it's worth, but there was a time not too long ago where at conferences or talking with just with colleagues, I was making the case that Trump, here I go with Trump again, but that Trump very much knows what he's reposting or retweeting. There was I got a screen grab of him retweeting Pepe the Frog. I have a screenshot of him from March of this year. It's called "Nothing Can Stop What's Coming," which is a very and it's a picture of him playing the violin. It's photoshopped. And he says, "Who knows what this means, but it sounds good to me." Now, I got sort of blowback that how could I possibly assume to know that Trump knows this? And my point was that it's pretty well, even if you scratch the surface of QAnon, you realize pretty quickly that there are certain catchphrases that are central, and "Nothing Can Stop What's Coming" is a big one. So it's in part, to get back to the core of your question, I think, you know, the age old kind of Nixonian plausible deniability, you know, like that. I'm looking at the tweet right now. I have it in a draft of a piece that actually was rejected, interestingly enough. But he writes, "Who knows what this means, but it sounds good to me." And okay, we could say, okay, is he an idiot? Does he not know? I tend to think he's more clever than people give him credit for. But the average person, the politician, the chef in Australia, if you're going to take part in the platforms, if you're going to have an account and engage in online communication, you're responsible for your content. You know, I mean, if you share something that is offensive to someone, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're a racist necessarily or homophobic or whatever, but you need to take ownership of what you're sharing. Yeah. Can I say something about that book, actually? Just real quick. One thing that I really sort of quietly proud about is the final chapter. And it's, I say quietly proud because I was really nervous to make the claim that I made in that chapter. And it's claiming that maybe we should think of memes as a new kind of art form. Because everyone's talking about it as a form of communication, but art is also a form of communication. And I don't really have a strong art history background. Okay, I did a lot of extra reading on it, and it just was bothering me for a while. There was no there, as one says. I just knew that there was, but I just couldn't find what it was. And then it hit me. Dadaism, early Dadaism from the 19, about 100 years ago, about 1916, 17 in Switzerland, It was this sort of bizarre art form that emerged in reaction to the horrors of the First World War, of a failure of all of Marxism, Catholicism, capitalism, whatever ism you want to pick. It just was a perceived failure of all these isms, all these beliefs that the Dadaists literally took pieces of encyclopedia or leather, and they would, you know, put it together in these bizarre montages. And I thought, well, that's really similar to what we do today, except it's digital. And I thought, well, how close is this comparison? How close can I make it? And I looked at some of the more known and some of the unknown Dada pieces, and I think that in order to understand a possible, I've been asked about like a post-meme world or post, you know, whatever that might be, we have to consider that there's a lot of unresolved issues, you know, be it people in denial about something, be it trauma, be it just, I don't know, hate or whatever. You know, there's a lot of shit going on, and for whatever reason, memes are like these signposts of something's not quite right within society. And I think even 5 years ago, if I had said that, you'd probably think I'm a bit of a loony, but not anymore. You know, not anymore, because we've seen that it can lead to death. It can lead to horrible outcomes. And I mean, I'm not concluding a deterministic link or causal link between the meme. It's just, if you're seeing enough of the same content that you agree with, as acerbic and vitriolic as it might be, you might be more inclined to live out the dark version of reality that you perceive anyway, you know, like a very, very dark and dystopian kind of take, which really is at the core of a lot of that Dadaist art, a rejection of society, rejected because they saw society as having failed. And
do you think that potentially is one of the kind of problematic form, I guess one of the problematic shackles that memes have is that they are at their core kind of just these often like artful expressions of opinions, but they are used to communicate so broadly and often literally in to the extent that they I think I mentioned at the top that they replace some small talk in deep relationships. I know in my life they at times replace journalism, and I'm learning real world news via memes and not looking deeper than the meme. I mean, I discovered Donald Trump had COVID in a meme. Is that part of the problem? Is that we're using them for such a broad spectrum and they don't come with labels that say art, news, or whatever, and that's where some confusion and power that they probably shouldn't have comes from?
Okay, the reason I'm not going to say the author's name, I respect this person's work very, very much, but I got into all of this back in 2013, I think. I was at the University of Arkansas. Very different from living in Austria, by the way. Thank God we're in Vienna. But anyways, and I read an article about memes, right? And it was in a very good journal, very good journal. And it pissed me off because I thought, what the hell is this person talking about? That's not what it is. It's this. So what I'm trying to say is it's almost like a kind of academic clique where people are trying desperately to have the definitive definition of the meme. It is very hard to classify. I'm saying that with regard to the literature itself, be it literature that might be included in the New York Times or some dusty academic journal. Like it's everything in between. You basically know what it is, but then when asked to define it in a way that makes sense, it becomes very broad, very general, and there's an inherent assumption that there is, and this is where it gets problematic, that it's either the memes are doing it or we are all doing it intentionally ourselves. But I wonder if there's a third option, that it's somehow a symptom of interacting with the infrastructure of the various platforms that we have. And you're right. Sometimes they're just hilarious. Sometimes they're basically a chunk of news. And maybe all of the above. Maybe it is art. You know, that's also why I thought of the Dadaist thing, because it's so a perfect example of like bricolage, pastiche, emerging together of this, that. It's very postmodern. I mean, I've been asked about what's next after memes, and I think that's missing the point. It's not necessarily about a next. It's about I think a deeper saturation, and possibly what I fear is a kind of shortening, a truncation of communication. Sort of that what happens with we call it like texting and emojis and such, that those can represent more sophisticated thoughts or complex thoughts, but yet are still encased within an image and maybe a little bit of text, and there's no exchange. There's an exchange of the material, if you will, but the meme, but there's no discourse. There's no discussion. There's no, it, you know, it, it's like a Twitterification of modern discourse. And in fact, in my book, I basically say, stop it, you know, stop, for God's sakes, man, stop using the memes to say something significant, like, you know, pick up the phone or write a letter. And I'm not trying to be traditionalist, old fashioned, but it's there's some value in stopping and saying, okay, what am I doing? What am I thinking about? What do I really think about this group? What do I know about this group? What do I know about these people? You know, I mean, some of, like, for example, the anti-trans memes are just so hateful. And I wonder how many of them have actually met a transgender person. Just they're just people. You know, it's that's just one of many examples, but. The point is that, if asked to define them, I take a very different direction. A lot of people feel a kind of obedience to Richard Dawkins and his creation of the term meme, but he was talking about something really quite different. And no disrespect to Sir Dawkins, but I take an old concept from Aristotle called the enthymeme. With an enthymeme basically is a visual argument where the viewer fills in the trick, the thing, the reason why it should be provocative or whatever. So I see it as a deeper. It's been a part of us. Let's just say it like this. It's been a part of human communication probably for a long time. It's just that the social platforms, the screens we carry, have made it so much easier to share. But for what? You know, like, what are you getting out of that? What are we actually, you know, is that really a good thing? Do we want to have political discourse, civil discourse through memes? It's a concern.
That brings me to one of, so a question that I definitely wanted to make sure I asked you was, you mentioned the concern for the future and people asking about post meme and stuff like that. My personal fear, particularly seeing the way Donald Trump's run to presidency and presidency played out, is that this guy who is in his 70s had so much success playing digital and social media and memes and stuff like that to his narrative. And this is a guy who clearly didn't grow up with it. What could somebody who was a digital native and, you know, both in terms of Photoshop and emerging technologies like deepfakes or whatever, but somebody who knows how to play with the tools and use them to great effect, but then also just has grown up where the inner workings of those communication tools are inherently part of the way they communicate. Is that something that, that we should be afraid of?
Yeah. I would be somewhat cautious. I don't know this for certain. Okay, but I would be cautious about assuming that Trump necessarily always knows what he's tweeting. To be fair, even though my earlier point about the QAnon thing suggested that he did know, I'm sure he's got a team. You know, of course he has a team. The example that I'm thinking of, though, it's a bit dark. Facebook. I don't know if you know about Facebook's platform called Free Basics. It's essentially a kind of browser, internet browser that's installed automatically on smartphones and distributed to poorer parts of the world. It's been well documented. This was the case in the Philippines and Myanmar, and the. The outcome of that is that the individuals day to day, be they reading, you know, whatever on their phones or looking at memes, whatever, these individuals, especially in the case in Myanmar, perceived the content as the internet and therefore truth. They didn't have another option. It's a really quite disturbing kind of experiment, if you will. And the end result was a UN high commissioner found that it was clear evidence of genocide against the minority Buddhist group called the Rohingya. So my point is the Facebook support team, I know for certain it stayed on with the Duterte regime in the Philippines, but both before his election and after, and they stayed on in support capacity. I don't know if this was the case in Myanmar. However, the example with Myanmar is I know that the Burmese word for chickpea, I don't know it, but the Burmese word for it is highly offensive to this minority Rohingya group. Well, Facebook was aware of the hate and they wanted to do something about it. So they were editing things. Well, they didn't edit the word chickpea. How the hell would they know? Right? So it's a hard question to answer because we pivot toward the individuals, the groups that we know of, and we forget the corporate entities. You know, we forget the fact that there's money to be made. I mean, I'm not saying that Facebook did this or that. I'm just saying that you know, there's a book by a gentleman by the name of Shiva Vajanathan called Anti-Social Media that documents it very well, and he's a very well-respected researcher. You know, it's all there, and it's some pretty disturbing shit. So it depends on the context, but I wanted to include that bit on the corporate part because it's not as it's not brought up as much as it should, I think.
So that's the episode. Thanks again to Dr. Bradley Wiggins for joining us. If you have enjoyed this episode, please do remember, subscribe if you haven't already. Tell a friend if you are a subscriber. If not, let me know what you'd like to hear. I'm always looking for new topics, new guests. So please get in touch with me on Instagram, Anthony Genot on Twitter, and we'll see if we can find an episode for you. Thanks. Talk to you next time.